supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Day two of Bill Cosby's sexual assault trial brought testimony from Cosby's accuser, Andrea Constand. WHYY's Bobby Allen has emerged from the courtroom and joins me now via Skype. Bobby, Constand's story is at the heart of the criminal case against Cosby. What happened when she took the stand today?
Hey, Dave. It was a pretty tense day in the Montgomery County Courthouse. First, reporters started whispering about the possibility of Constand showing up. Every time I saw another reporter, the rumor was circulated back to me. Everyone knew it was coming. And then she snuck in the back door, and a photo of Andrea Constand in the hallway of the Montgomery County Courthouse was being circulated by the press pool photographer, as showing up on wire reports, and everyone in the courthouse said, is today the day? Is she going to take the stand? And she did. And she got up on the witness stand today, and her demeanor was striking, Dave. She was cool, composed, headstrong. She told the jurors about meeting Cosby through the Temple basketball program. At the time, you know, she wanted to get into a sports broadcasting career and saw Bill Cosby as a way to launch that professional aspiration. But she also described the 2004 incident, which triggered the criminal charges and which is the reason why we're all here at the courthouse today. And through it all, through direct examination, from the prosecution and on cross-examination from Cosby's defense attorney, she remained pretty cool and composed and just very matter-of-fact, very cooperative. She was rather courteous, too. She kept addressing counsel, yes, sir, yes, ma'am. Her level of control throughout the whole testimony was really something to witness. It was really striking.
Was there a contrast in her demeanor under cross-exam from Cosby's defense team?
Well, just by nature of cross-examination, it was a more combative interaction. Basically, what Angela Agrusa, who is part of the legal defense team trying to get Bill Cosby acquitted, tried to highlight were inconsistencies in her story. And I'll just give you two off the top of my head. She originally told police, you know, back in 2005, she had not contacted Cosby after the incident. And they said, look at these dozens and dozens of phone calls. We subpoenaed your phone records. How do you explain that? You told the police you didn't contact him. Why'd you call him more than 50 times? You know, they said you said you had never had any kind of sexual interaction with him before. Well, there's these two instances that you said were suggestive, sexually suggestive. Why didn't you tell police that originally? You know, they're really prodding her. They're really putting her under the judicial scrutiny that comes with cross-examination. I mean, this is part of the process. She knew she was going to be subjected to this. But I will say throughout, despite it being a pretty rough go for Andrea Constand, she was tough and she pushed through, but it's not over, right? Cross-examination wrapped for the day, but it's picking back up tomorrow morning.
Could you get a sense of reaction from jurors and Cosby during Constand's testimony?
Yeah, you know, it's actually, as a side note, there's a giant screen in front of the jurors where exhibits are being displayed to them, various evidence and documents, and it's so large that members of the press can only really glimpse two or three of the jurors. They're behind this giant screen. It's pretty distracting. But the ones I could keep my eye on, you know, some of them, you could see them maybe getting bored at times and looking away or not totally engaged. But when Andrea Constand took the stand, they really became engaged and they really zeroed in on her. They seemed to be really following along. And because she is the star witness, her story is the crux of this criminal matter. So it's their obligation to really pay attention closely. Cosby, meanwhile, you know, he had kind of a smug look on his face at times. One reporter wrote on social media that he was rolling his eyes at certain points. I saw him just as I did yesterday when his expression was just kind of expressionless and stoic, you know, just sort of holding on to his wooden cane and not reacting much. But yeah, I guess when Andrea Constand took the stand, he did show some glum expressions on his face, but he didn't get too animated.
Constand, the star witness, but not the only witness to testify today.
Yeah, that's right. Before Constand testified, we heard from two others. We heard from a law enforcement official, a police detective from Canada, who initially responded to Constant, arrived at Constant's mom's home in the Ontario, Canada area after she reported the incident, and he recounted what that process was like. He walked in the door, sat down, talked to Andrea Constant. He showed her photos of her and Cosby over the months that their friendship had been growing, and then described the incident where she says she was violated. So we had the detective describing that in his own words, which was powerful. And then we also had an attorney speak who was connected to a talent agency in L.A., which had to deal with a prior witness, victim number six, Kelly Johnson, who made remarks under a deposition as part of a lawsuit with that agency about how Cosby caused her so much stress. Among other factors, she had to leave that agency. So this attorney was basically saying, yeah, you know, Cosby was a factor in this other alleged victim's life, and he caused her so much emotional distress that she did want to leave the job because the agency was representing Cosby at the time.
WHYY's Bobby Allen reporting from the courthouse in Norristown. Democratic and Republican registered voters in New Jersey have until 8 this evening to cast ballots in today's primary election. Let's go to the polls with Ben Dworkin, political science professor at Rider University and director of the Rebovich Institute for New Jersey Politics. Ben, thanks for joining us again on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
This was supposed to be low turnout, and that's before the dreary weather. Make the case for voters still on the fence. They don't have much time.
Well, it's important to figure out where the state's going to be going in the post-Chris Christie era. I think Democrats have to figure out what kind of direction they want. They've got four major candidates to choose from. The Republicans also have to decide what kind of party they're going to become in the aftermath of Chris Christie, as he is term limited and won't be around. So each party, really, it's important for people who are partisan to come out and vote before 8 o'clock tonight to really set the direction for their party for the future.
Two-term governors in New Jersey are typically succeeded by a member from the opposite party. To what extent, then, is this a referendum on Governor Chris Christie?
It's not much of a referendum at all at this point. Chris Christie, who has the lowest popularity ratings of any governor in the country right now, will certainly be a factor in the November election. But when it comes to deciding who is going to be the Republican nominee and who's going to be the Democratic nominee, he's there, but it's not much of a major impact on people's decisions.
Campaigning with frontrunner Phil Murphy last month, former Vice President Joe Biden called the election the single most important race in the country in the next 3 years. Biden hyperbole, or is there some truth to it? And if so, again, why is turnout so low?
As much as I love New Jersey politics, that's a bit of hyperbole from the former vice president. It is a significant race. Only Virginia and New Jersey have gubernatorial races in 2017. This is what we call an off-year election. And so it will take on a certain significance because if Democrats are able to sweep both of these races, as they may well do, it's going to be seen as a sign of Democratic resurgence in the era of Trump. So it will take on more significance nationally than they even are in their own states, where people are going to be deciding about state issues.
Phil Murphy, he with the unlimited resources for his own campaign and the support of all the counties, is facing off against Jim Johnson, John Wisniewski, and Ray Lesniak. Is there much daylight between the platforms of each of those four?
There isn't much. These are all four very progressive people. They are looking for a progressive agenda. The Democrats are in firm control of both houses of the state legislature in New Jersey. And a lot of the things that they've wanted to do have been stopped by Chris Christie, a very conservative Republican. So I think you have Democrats throughout the state who are looking forward to an opportunity to implement an agenda by finally having a governor who's ready to sign bills that are passed by the Democrats in the legislature.
So what are some of the key items on that agenda?
We're going to have to deal with our financial situation in this state. The job growth is lagging. It's significant, but it's still lagging behind. People feel frustrated because of that. Property taxes are still an issue. So what you're going to see are things like probably a millionaire's tax. There'll probably be a new level of taxation imposed again on our highest income wage earners in the state. We're going to probably see a significant change in the way we distribute school aid funding, which will have an impact on property taxes, which ordinarily go to pay overwhelmingly for local schools. Marijuana legalization is going to be an issue, and then a whole host of other kinds of priorities relating to investments in social services and transportation infrastructure that I think the Democrats are looking forward to pushing on their own without Chris Christie to stop them.
Is there a sense of irony that the former Goldman Sachs multimillionaire executive is the leading progressive candidate in the state?
For some in the state, it's a bit ironic. For others in the Democratic Party, it's actually a non-starter. They simply won't vote for somebody who's a multimillionaire but is running as an advocate for the working class. But what's clear, based on the polling and what I think we'll see tonight, is that those voices are simply not a majority of the Democratic Party here in New Jersey. You know, this is not Kansas, it's New Jersey. There are lots of people who work in finance here, who work on Wall Street. So being someone who has been successful on Wall Street is not in and of itself a disqualifying characteristic here in this Democratic Party.
Ben Dworkin, thanks as always for providing insight.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Ben Dworkin, political science professor at Rider University and director of the Rebovich Institute for New Jersey Politics. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Delaware Governor John Carney is promising to implement recommendations to improve prison conditions in the first state. The pledge comes 4 months after a correctional officer was killed by inmates during a February uprising. WHYY's Nichelle Polston reports.
In response to an independent review by the Delaware Department of Correction that examined the environment that led to a deadly hostage-taking at the James T. Vaughn Correctional Center, Governor John Carney says a few things are at the top of his agenda.
So one of the most important issues that we all know about is staffing and compensation. It's been discussed. It's whether we had the event on February the 1st or not. We've been struggling with issues right now as we speak. There are over 100 vacancies for correctional officers.
In addition to adding new staff, a special person will be appointed to improve management and training at the Department of Correction. Another person will be recruited to help reduce recidivism. Senator Margaret Rose Henry, who has worked on criminal justice reform in the past, supports Carney's promises.
The important thing is that we are now talking and listening to one another, and are moving forward to address some of the structural issues that will improve the conditions in our prisons for both our guards as well as our inmate population.
Although critics have voiced their concerns about the report and whether it does enough to improve conditions for inmates, Jeffrey Klopp, head of the Correctional Officers Association, says the inmates are also a priority.
You know, once we get the staffing addressed and get proper staffing, we will be able to then give the inmates the programs that we need. Look, we know the inmates need help too, but we have to have enough staff, and then we'll be able to hopefully move forward with new programs and new possibilities for the inmates to get rehabilitation.
Governor Carney is promising to incorporate these changes in the budget to be passed this month. From the Delaware Desk, Nichelle Polston, WHYY News.
Pre-K is getting a lot of love these days from politicians and advocates. But that love doesn't always translate to a sustainable business model for those who run early education centers. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron has more on a report showing just how hard it is to provide high-quality care at affordable rates.
Good morning. How are you?
Mary Graham has been at Children's Village in Philadelphia's Chinatown section since 1976, long enough to learn a few tricks. Take, for instance, the conventional pre-K classroom on the building's fifth floor that magically transforms into an after-school program.
So this classroom becomes a school-age room at 331.
To keep her nonprofit center open, Graham makes sure there are as many children in as many classrooms for as many hours as possible. And even then, her budget can get tight.
If you're doing quality, it's not profitable.
That was the conclusion of the nonprofit group Research for Action, which recently dove into the budgets of Children's Village and a handful of other private centers around Pennsylvania. Researchers found that state subsidies don't cover the true cost of providing high-quality pre-K. The economics are even worse for centers serving infants and toddlers. State subsidies for toddler and infant care haven't budged in a decade, even though it's a lot more expensive to deliver the service. As a result, centers are shifting to enroll more pre-K students, whose attendance is at least less harmful to a center's bottom line.
Advocates are very concerned that what happens when centers serve just preschool?
It's a tricky balance. More high-quality pre-K sounds great, but it sounds less appealing if it comes at the expense of kids just a year or two younger. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Every year, around 13 people die when they're struck by SEPTA trains. Some are accidents, others intentional acts by those seeking to end their lives. SEPTA is trying to reduce the number of deaths, but as Jim Saxa of WHYY's Plan Philly reports, mere words might not be enough.
13. It's a number we avoid. 13 is bad luck. For SEPTA, 13 is a somber figure. Every year, 13 people die after being hit by a SEPTA train. Some are accidents. Most are suicides. To fight this, SEPTA has launched an annual campaign to urge its customers and the public at large to stay safe around trains. This year's theme?
Respect the train.
That's Jeff Knuppel, SEPTA's general manager at a recent rail safety event. SEPTA's trains, especially regional rail, move with deceptive speed and surprising quiet. A train slowing down as it comes into station still covers a few hundred yards in a matter of seconds before it comes to a full stop. To prevent accidents from people walking on or along the tracks, SEPTA has put up fences and warnings. Knuppel says those efforts have helped reduce the number of accidents.
We are getting the right-of-way issues. We're kind of doing well with them, where people are trespassing and with grade crossings, but the suicide situation seems to be getting worse.
SEPTA placed signs for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at all its train stations. It isn't clear if just seeing a sign can actually prevent a suicide attempt, but that doesn't mean they're pointless. The signs have led to an uptick in calls to the hotline, and they can help the public realize that train platforms are places where some go to kill themselves, says Jonathan Singer, a professor at Loyola University Chicago and secretary of the American Association of Suicidology.
So if you're at a train station and you see somebody that seems distraught, maybe looking and peering into the tracks, it's giving you some indication that they might jump. The first thing to do is to just start talking to them. Hey, how you doing? How about that game last night? You know, anything that can engage them.
You don't have to be a therapist, Singer says, just a friendly stranger. And if that person says they're having dark thoughts, that's what the hotline is for. But despite the signs, the morbid numbers remain steady. There have been 7 fatalities already this year. 5 were deemed suicides. SEPTA is now considering walls to keep people off the tracks of the Broad Street and Market Frankford lines. As part of the ongoing renovation of City Hall Station, SEPTA may install barriers with glass doors that will open when the train arrives. Singer says those work really well.
Barriers are effective in reducing suicide deaths. Having a barrier literally prevents somebody from killing themselves at that spot.
And Singer adds, if someone is prevented from killing themselves with one method, research shows they are unlikely to try a different one. SEPTA's engineers are still figuring out whether they can actually build the barriers in such a cramped space. If they manage it, though, those thin plexiglass panes may become the line between life and death. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
A state historic marker was unveiled today in Philadelphia at 23rd and Girard Streets, outside the former home of the founder of the Dixie Hummingbirds, one of the most influential gospel groups of all time. More from WHYY's Peter Crimmins.
The Dixie Hummingbirds were formed 89 years ago by James Davis in Greenville, South Carolina, when he was just 12 years old. Later in 1942, the gospel group relocated to Philadelphia. Davis bought a house at 23rd and Girard Avenue and used it as a rehearsal space.
He was the greatest manager ever lived.
That's the Reverend Joe Williams, who used to sing in a gospel group called the Sons of the Birds, and then graduated to be a Dixie Hummingbird at age 45.
3 months I was in that same house in the front room for 3 months straight, every night, trying to get my part. It's a hard group to beat.
The Lord woke me up this morning to the
Williams pushed the state to erect a marker here for 10 years, ever since James Davis died in 2007 at age 90. State historic markers are issued by the Pennsylvania Historic and Museum Commission. Its board chair, Nancy Moses, said the Dixie Hummingbirds transcended their Baptist roots.
They are the soul of music. Their music reaches across time and cultures and enters into the human heart.
Yeah, I can see you have to dip into me.
I got somebody to get
rid of, you see me shout.
I got so much.
On hand at the marker unveiling was Mayor Jim Kenney, who held up the Dixie Hummingbirds as universal role models.
I love being Catholic, but every now and then a Baptist service will lift you off your feet a little bit. You know?
And I thank the Lord for letting me live.
Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
You know, I got good religion and I'm not ashamed.